about his annual visits to the Carrion Plateau as a teenager, about the tests he had endured there, and about the training he had undergone at the hands of his wilderness-experienced elder relatives and various guides. Vader paid close attention, interrupting him several times to ask for clarification or additional detail. As Tarkin obliged, one part of him took note of how strange it felt to be having an actual dialogue with the Dark Lord. In the recent days they had spent together, their exchanges had been limited to a few sentences, and more typically had been one-sided. Vader's mask was responsible for some of that, complicating the process of conversation. But just now, Vader's frequent downward glances suggested that he was actually listening. So Tarkin went on talking, opening up about his experiences on the plateau while they continued down the Executrix's broad central corridor toward the waiting shuttle. By the time I was 16, I had come to know the plateau almost as well as I knew the grounds of my parents' home in Iriadu City, Tarkin said. There was one area that we avoided, however. A vast stretch of savanna, interrupted by stands of thick forest. It wasn't precisely off-limits. In fact, on several occasions, I understood that my uncle was taking us well out of the way simply so I could get a glimpse of the territory. Each time he did so, he would explain that we were not alone in being the plateau's reigning predators. And while there was no denying that our blasters were capable of eliminating all competitors, an act of that nature would have flown in the face of keeping the plateau pristine. One goal of the training was to help me understand how to place myself at the top of the food chain through fear rather than force, and how best to maintain my position. The territory we always seemed to skirt was there to provide me with another lesson, as it was ruled over by our chief competitors on the plateau, a 100-strong troop of especially vicious primates. He paused to glance up at Vader. Are you familiar with the Viamok? Vader nodded.
I've had some experience with the species, Governor.
Tarkin waited for more, but Vader said nothing. Well, then you know how ferocious they can be on their own, let alone in a group. There's scarcely a creature they can't outwit or outfight when they set their minds to it. But the species on Iriadu is probably not the one you are familiar with. The Iriadu Viamok stands a meter high, but is sleek-skinned rather than woolly, is social rather than solitary, and is ardently territorial. It has adapted to the dry conditions of the plateau, rather than to swamps and moist woodlands. Like the more ordinary species, it has razor-sharp claws, equally sharp teeth in its canine muzzle, and the strength of 10 humans. Its powerful arms and upper torso appear made for climbing, but the Iriadu Viamok is generally not arboreal. Like all its brethren, however, it is a swift and voracious carnivore. At the center of the terrain the troop controlled stands a 100-meter-tall hill that more resembles a rock fortress. Crowning it is a 4-sided spire of black volcanic glass, some 20 meters high and flat at the top. A time-eroded shaft of quickly cooled magma, to be sure, as are the boulders that support it. Vader looked at him.
The Carrion Spike.
Just so, Tarkin said. Without Jova having to say as much, I began to grasp that the spike was to be the site of my final test. Vader interrupted his rhythmic breathing to make a sound of acknowledgement.
Your trial.
Tarkin nodded. I was in the midst of my second season on the plateau when Jova first pointed the spike out to me. But my trial, as you say, wouldn't take place for 4 years to come. When that time arrived, he explained what was expected of me. I merely had to spend an entire day at the spike, on my own. I would have neither food nor water, but I would be allowed to carry a vibro-lance of the sort we used in some of our hunts.
A vibro-lance?
Vader said. An electroshock weapon, longer and lighter than the force pike. It has the same vibro-edged head, but is balanced in such a way that it can also be hurled, like a spear. Mine would be primed with a limited number of charges, though Jova didn't specify how many. In any case, if I could accomplish that, spend a single day at the spike, my final test would be behind me, and I would no longer be compelled to visit the Carrion Plateau, unless, of course, it was my desire to do so.
You must have thought it a simple task,
Vader said.
Initially, indeed, Tarkin said. Until Jova allowed me to observe the hill and the spire through macro binoculars.
Your eyes were opened.
Jova said that I could take as much time as I needed to assess the situation and decide on a course of action, and I spent the better part of my sixth season on the plateau doing just that. The first order of business was to get to know my enemy, which I did over the course of the first couple of weeks. I would conceal myself in areas of forest or in the tall savanna grass and observe the routines of the Viamox, which rarely varied from day to day. Or perhaps it's better to say night to night, since that was when they would emerge from their hill caves and set out on communal hunts. The feasting that resulted from their hunts would continue for most of the night, sometimes at the site of their kills, or sometimes back at the caves, where the females fed their grey-skinned young. With the return of the light and the heat, the males would ascend to the top of the hill and sprawl on the rocks at the foot of the spike, which I was never able to get a good look at, even through the macro binoculars, as the hill was the tallest feature for kilometers around in every direction. Mid-afternoon, the Viamox would make their descent, gathering at a watering hole to drink before repeating the entire routine. The waterhole became my preferred place for observing them, and it was there where I began to get to know some members of the troop individually. Their dominant member was a dark-striped male, large and battle-scarred, to whom I gave the name Lord. During my weeks of stealthy observation, I saw him challenged at regular intervals. Sometimes the fights would be to the death, but more often Lord would allow challengers to limp away in shame, but remain part of the troop. Since it was impossible to defeat him, there was much competition among his subordinates to get close to him. In some sense, the fights were as much about training as they were displays of supremacy. Lord was teaching the weaker males, aware that he would eventually have to yield his position for the sake of the troop. The rest understood this, and as a result, followed his lead in all matters. I don't think the species is capable of abstract thought, much less truly sentient, but they do communicate with one another through a complex language of displays and vocalizations. There was a second male that caught my attention, a younger and smaller Viamox, who always seemed to be in Lord's shadow, so that was how I began to think of him. Shadow would tag behind and watch Lord from a respectful distance. Sometimes Lord wouldn't abide the scrutiny and would run Shadow off. At other times he tolerated the younger Viamox's attempts to learn from him. What interested me most, however, was that Shadow had a following of his own, a subgroup of some 8 young males who accompanied him wherever he went. Lord tolerated them as well, so long as they kept their distance, which they always did, retreating if he so much as turned in their direction. It was at the waterhole that Shadow and his group began to take an interest in me. They observed me observing them, and began to study me as something curious that had showed up at the edge of their carefully defined domain. Sated from the previous night's hunt, and having dismissed me as a threat, they demonstrated no immediate interest in killing me. At that point in my life, I had never heard of a Viamox being domesticated, but I had heard of people who used the creatures as watch beasts, and I imagined that it was possible to enter into some sort of partnership with them. I thought that perhaps I could make use of them as allies of a sort, either when I was at the spike or in making my escape. And so each day I would try to edge closer to them, only to have them challenge me on every occasion, forcing me back across the invisible line of their hunting grounds. When I determined I had seen enough, I set myself to the task of thinking through the separate challenges I faced. Getting to the top of the hill, climbing the spike, and getting away, assuming I even survived the ordeal. Neither Jova nor any of the others offered help. Getting to the hill was going to require nothing more than moving while the Veermops were in the caves. I would emerge from the copse of forest closest to the hill, cross an expanse of savanna, and pick my way through the boulders to the top. There would be no shade and no rest, and some of the crevasses between the boulders appeared deep enough to swallow me whole. If I wasn't safely at the top by the time the Veermocks emerged from the caves, I'd likely be torn apart on the hill. The spike itself presented problems of a different sort. The edges of the black glass column appeared sharp enough to cut through cloth, or hide, or human flesh. So I devised a strap made from a geranium-threaded belt I found among replacement parts for the old speeder we used from time to time, and from that same belt I also fashioned thick soles for my boots and protective pads for my hands. I knew that even the Veermock's muscular legs weren't powerful enough to propel them to the top of the spike. But there was still the matter of my remaining on the flat summit for the entire day. Especially after Jova allowed that the Veermocks might delay their nocturnal hunt until they had dealt with me. The Vibro-Lance was meant to counter that eventuality, though the lance wouldn't contain enough charges to kill or stun all of the males. Worse still, they weren't frightened of the Vibro-Lance. In run-ins we'd had with solitary Veermocks, they had evinced no fear even of blasters, and had often proved agile enough to dodge beams. Add to this that I would have to scramble down and fight my way to the bottom of the hill and cross the savanna in darkness. That was where some of my predecessors had failed their initiations. Jova said that I would see what remained of their bones scattered about, as if the spike was some sort of Tarkin reliquary. To provide myself with an advantage, I spent days working with a shovel, while the males were lazing on the hill and the females were in the caves tending to the young, to excavate a series of traps and pits along what would be my escape route. Some little more than deep holes, others with floors of sharpened stakes. Then the day came. I made my crossing through the tall grass and scampered up onto the porous, fine-grained rocks. One slip, and I could have broken an ankle or become permanently wedged between the boulders. Venomous insects attacked me from hidden nests. Stinging ants streamed out from hills of their own making. Serpents rattled in forewarning. The heat beat down on me. Nature had conspired to make the hill a last stand against technology and civilization. A place engineered to test a sentient's resolve to conquer and survive. But I endured. The spike loomed above me like a lightning rod, a solidified puddle of black glass at its base. I threw the strap around it, planted the thick soles of my boots against the edges, and hauled myself up centimeters at a time. The ascent took much longer than I had anticipated, and I had scarcely reached the flat, slightly angled top, when the first of the Veermocks arrived. Seeing me there, sitting cross-legged atop the spike, the Vibro-Lance hanging over my shoulder, they began to hop and circle round in mounting, growling agitation, uncertain, perhaps awaiting instructions from Lord. Alone among them, however, Shadow merely sat on his haunches to watch me, communicating with members of his clique by clacking vocalizations. Finally, Lord made his appearance, gazing up at me with fury in his eyes, and what struck me as hatred at having to be put to a test so early in the day. I wondered if some of my ancestors had survived by killing the dominant Veermock, thinking that would dissuade the rest. But I didn't believe that would work, not with Shadow standing by to assume leadership. As if by the power of voice alone he could dislodge me from my perch, Lord barked louder than the rest combined. After all, it was incumbent on him to deal with this intruder. But before he had a chance to act, Shadow issued another series of vocal clackings that prompted his followers to launch an attack on the spike from all sides, their lethal claws scoring the volcanic glass with a sound that made every nerve in my body jangle. As if intent on splitting my attention, some fainted, while others leapt as high as their legs could carry them. They roared and gnashed their big triangular teeth, but I refused to give in to fear. Moreover, something unusual was going on. The attacks by Shadow's minions were chaotic, nothing at all like the well-coordinated exercises I had watched them utilize during hunts. The turmoil sent Lord into a rage. Desperate to restore order, he batted at the young males who were charging back and forth or trying to gain purchase on the glass. He drew blood from a few but was unable to control them. I glanced at Shadow in time to hear him issue a low, warbling groan. And at once, the young males turned on Lord with teeth and claws set to one purpose. For a moment, the old Veermok champion seemed too confused to respond, almost as if the communal attack violated their code of behavior, some etiquette particular to the species. Quickly, though, he realized that he had to fight for his life, and he gave himself over to defending himself, killing three of the young males before the rest finally got the better of him. And throughout it all, Shadow didn't move a muscle.
"An assassination,"
Vader said,
"with you providing the necessary distraction."
Tarkin nodded. An opportunity they had long been waiting for.
"And the pretender, Shadow."
Tarkin forced an exhale. I gave the Veermoks a moment to lord their new leader. Then I hurled my lance and promptly killed him. I might as well have dropped a bomb on the hill. One moment the young Veermoks didn't know what to make of their victory in overcoming Lord. Now they behaved as if they had nowhere to turn. Without a leader, a true inheritor, they fell victim to a kind of bewildered grief, an almost existential despair. They dropped to their bellies and stared up at me in almost docile expectation. I didn't trust them, but I had no option but to descend the spike at sunset, and when I threaded among them to retrieve my lance from Shadow's inert body, not one of them loosed even so much as a growl, and they actually followed me down the hill.
"What was your uncle's reaction?"
Vader asked. "Jova said it was good to see me in one piece, particularly since he and the others had wagered that my bones would be joining those of my ancestors." Tarkin paused before adding, "The following morning, the Veermok troop abandoned the hill and the spike. They left the plateau and weren't seen again."
"They failed to realize what they would bring down on themselves by turning on their leader,"
Vader said. "Precisely."
"Then you are the last Tarkin to have passed the test."
Tarkin nodded. "That particular test, yes." By then they had reached the shuttle bay. Tarkin walked alongside Vader to the foot of the ramp. "Safe journey, Lord Vader. Be sure to give the pretender my regards."
"Rest assured, Governor Tarkin."
With an abrupt nod of his head and a swirl of his black cloak, Vader disappeared up the ramp, and Tarkin started for the Star Destroyer's command bridge. Chapter 21. Dissolution. The Sekitor-class Star Destroyer Conquest hung in fixed orbit above the Karida Imperial Navy Deep Dock Facility 2, some 500,000 kilometers from the eponymous planet. On the bridge, Vice Admiral Rancid received an update from the ship's commander. "Sir, the Carrion Spike has reverted to real space, bearing 003 ecliptic. Target is acquired. Firing solutions have been computed, and all starboard batteries are standing by." Rancid took a final look at the myriad ships that made up the task force and turned from the bridge viewport.
"Prepare to fire on my command."
"Awaiting your word."
"Belay that command,"
a voice boomed from the rear of the command bridge. Rancid, the commander, and several nearby officers and specialists turned in unison to see Darth Vader storming forward on the elevated walkway, his cape billowing behind him, a squad of armed stormtroopers marching in step in his black wake.
"Lord Vader,"
Rancid said in genuine surprise.
"I wasn't informed you were aboard."
"With purpose, Vice Admiral,"
Vader said, then swung to the bridge officer.
"Commander, direct your technicians to scan the carrion spike for life forms."
The commander looked to Rancid, who returned a dubious nod.
"Do as he orders."
Vader came to a halt in the center of the walkway and put his gloved hands on his hips, fingers forward.
"Well, Commander?"
The commander straightened from peering at a console over the shoulder of one of the specs.
"These scanners aren't picking up any life signs."
He glanced at Rancid in confusion.
"Sir, the Corvette is deserted and appears to be astrogating on autopilot."
Rancid shook his head in denial.
"But that can't be."
Vader looked at him.
"Your co-conspirators abandoned the ship before it jumped to hyperspace, Vice Admiral."
Alarm found its way into Rancid's perplexity.
"My co-conspirators, Lord Vader?"
"Don't act surprised,"
Vader said.
"This entire charade was yours from the start."
Rancid tightened his fists and worked his jaw while the warship's commander and the rest exchanged worried glances. When he began to move toward one of the forward chairs, Vader raised his hand and clenched it.
"Stay right where you are, Vice Admiral."
Vader pointed his finger at the bridge officer.
"Order the commanders of the Task Force flotilla to stand down from general quarters."
The bridge officer nodded and walked backward to the communications board.
"Immediately, Lord Vader."
Vader turned to Rancid once more.
"You made a deal with some of your former intelligence assets. Displeased with certain events that occurred at the end of the war, they were seeking a way to avenge themselves on the Empire, and you provided one. You allowed them access to confiscated technologies, and you facilitated the theft of Governor Tarkin's ship after luring him into your plot with counterfeit holotransmissions. You supplied them with tactical information along the way, and by doing so, you are complicit in the deaths of thousands of Imperial effectives and the destruction of Imperial facilities."
Vader paced to the viewports and returned, positioning himself a meter from Rancid.
"You assured your co-conspirators that they would be allowed to strike at Carita and continue their reign of terror. But in fact, you planned to betray them here, seeing to their deaths and so eliminating everyone who had been witness to your treachery. By having predicted where they would show themselves, and by having put an end to their campaign, you would have earned the approval of the Emperor. And what, Vice Admiral? Exactly what did you hope to achieve?"
Rancid regarded him with sudden loathing.
"You, of all people, need to ask."
Vader said nothing for a long moment, then approximated a sniff.
"Power, Admiral. Influence. Perhaps you simply felt overlooked. That you, too, should have been named a moth."
Rancid bit back whatever he had in mind to say.
"If only you had been one step ahead of your co-conspirators, rather than one step behind,"
Vader continued in false lament.
"Consider how far you might have risen in the Emperor's estimation had you been able to predict that they would betray you and go on to execute the plan they had in mind from the beginning."
Curiosity seeped into Rancid's rigid expression.
"What plan?"
"This system was never meant to be their final target, Vice Admiral. The deal they made with you merely gave them free rein to carry out a mission of their own. They transferred to a different ship, and are now on their way to the actual target."
"Where?"
Rancid asked in an insistent tone.
"That is not your concern. Understand as well, Vice Admiral, that the Emperor has long held suspicions about you. He allowed your scheme to unfold as a means of ensnaring everyone involved in your conspiracy.
Rancid's courage returned.
What is the target, Vader? Tell me.
Your apprehension is misplaced,
Vader said in a menacingly calm voice. He lifted his right hand and began to bring his thumb and fingers together, then stopped.
No. You have already determined the method of your execution.
He swung to the squad of stormtroopers.
Lieutenant Crest, Admiral Rancid is to be escorted to and placed inside an escape pod. I will give the order to launch the pod, and Admiral Rancid, once removed to a distance from this vessel, will issue the fire order that destroys it.
Vader glanced over his shoulder at Rancid.
Does that meet with your approval, Vice Admiral?
Rancid snarled.
I won't beg you, Vader.
It would not affect the outcome in any case.
Vader nodded to the stormtroopers, who moved forward to surround Rancid.
One last thing, Vice Admiral,
Vader said, as Rancid was being escorted aft down the walkway.
Moff Tarkin sends his regards.
A warship lay in wait in the shadow of a cratered, waterless moon in a star system coreward of the Gulf of Tatooine. Since it was not the product of a major shipbuilding conglomerate, the vessel lacked both a name and a registered signature. It was instead a farrago, a medley of modules, components, turbo lasers, and ion cannons acquired by its assemblers from Imperial surplus depots, deep space salvagers, smugglers, and others in the business of selling stolen parts and prescribed armaments. Fittingly, the ship most resembled the Quarren Free Dak Volunteer Corps' Providence-class carrier, but at less than half the length was stubby by comparison and did not boast an aft communications tower. Its belly housed several squadrons of droid starfighters, and its weapons were operated by computer-controlled droids. But the ship was commanded by sentients. In this case, a small group of humans, Kurovar and Gotals, along with a Sol Mon Cal Starship Systems engineer. It was the sort of vessel that would become closely associated with Outer Rim pirates in the post-war years. And in fact, it was the same capital ship that had briefly revealed itself at Sentinel Base weeks earlier. We've come full circle, Teller was telling Artos in the starfighter hangar. Dressed in a flight suit, he had a helmet under one arm and was standing alongside a warming headhunter, retrofitted with a rudimentary hyperdrive, the very model Hask had used in crafting the false holovid that had been transmitted to Sentinel Base. For the benefit of Knots and the handful of other sentient pilots, Arto said,
The convoy will revert to real space at the edge of this system and continue by sublight to the Imperial Marshalling Station at Pi. From there, supply ships are escorted to Sentinel Base and finally to Geonosis.
Not this convoy, Knots said. The world-weary human broker had helped pilot the hodgepodge carrier from its place of concealment near Lantilles. Rancid did us a great favor by reallocating the convoy's protection. He promised us clear skies at Corita and gave us just that here, Teller said. He had no reason to believe he'd be leaving the convoy vulnerable. He was simply shuffling ships around for show. Any word from Corita? Knots asked.
Nothing yet,
Artos said. The evidence trail that links him to us is too much of a maze for anyone to follow, Teller said. Accusations will be flying every which way about our not getting apprehended, but the assumption will be that we simply abandoned the cause. Rancid won't be happy with being denied his expected promotion, Knots said. He'll be on the hunt for us for betraying him. Teller shrugged that off and glanced at Artos. Any suggestion Rancid makes about our being involved in the attack on the convoy would only make matters worse for him for pulling ships away. Rancid'll be lucky to be removed from naval intelligence with his pension intact, let alone be in a position to pose a threat to us.
And Tarkin?
The Mon Cal asked. He gets back what's left of his precious corvette, Knots said before Teller could reply. Tarkin won't be held accountable for any of it, Teller added. He's a moth. And besides, it wasn't his idea to go to Mercana. He shook his head with finality. I'm guessing he retains command of Sentinel Base. Knotts nodded in agreement. The question is, will he come after us? Oh, you can count on that, Teller said. We're going to need to scatter far and wide. The corporate sector is probably our safest bet. No one spoke for a long moment. Then Knotts said, Once the convoy is history, how far will we have set them back? Artos replied,
Work on the hyperdrive components alone had been in progress for 3 years before I was sent to Desolation Station. Even with perfected plans and a redoubling of their efforts, I suspect that we will set them back 4 years.
Teller smiled lightly. I wish we had a better sense of what they're up to at Geonosis. A weapons platform of some sort, Knotts said. Do we need to know more than that? Teller looked at him. I suppose not. If we can just keep delaying them with strikes. Once the rest of the galaxy gets to know the Emperor as well as we know him, we won't be alone in the fight. Doubt surfaced in Artos's huge, glistening eyes.
With shipyards turning out Imperial-class star destroyers, any revolt will be hard-pressed to make so much as a dent in the Emperor's armor. Even if we can continue to impede construction of whatever they are building at Geonosis, something unexpected is going to have to enter the mix in order for any rebellion to succeed. Yes, people will begin to recognize the truth about the Empire, but numbers alone will never make the difference. Not against the likes of the Emperor, Vader, and the military they're amassing. And don't expect the Senate to restrain them, because it is even less effective than it was during the Republic.
Teller gave his head a defiant shake.
We can either decide right now that it's hopeless and call it a day, or we can hold out for hope and do what we can.
That decision has never been in dispute,
Arto said.
For Antar IV, then, and for a brighter future, Knotts said.
Heads nodded in concert. While the assembled pilots were moving toward their starfighters, Carla hurried into the hangar.
The supply convoy has dropped from hyperspace. Holonet and communications jammers are enabled, and all weapons systems are standing by.
Knotts extended his hand to Teller.
Good luck out there.
Teller shook his old friend's hand and tugged the helmet down over his head. Turning to Carla, he said,
Tell Lenora and Hask that we expect nothing less than a galactic-class holovid.
The attack on the battle station convoy was well underway by the time the Executrix reverted from hyperspace close enough to a small moon to all but tweak its orbit. Tarkin and several officers were at the viewports as the stars shrank back into themselves. With his booted legs spread, hands clasped behind his back, graying hair swept back from his high forehead as if blown in the wind, the governor might have been the vessel's figurehead, taunting the enemy to face off with him personally in mortal combat.
Sir, they've jammed the local holonet relay, a spec reported from behind him. That's why our alerts weren't received. For the moment, our countermeasures are managing to keep the battle and tactical nets open.
Can we communicate with any of the convoy transports? Tarkin asked, without turning around.
Negative, sir. It's possible we're not even registering on their scanners.
Keep trying. The boxy cargo ships and transports that made up the convoy had drawn together to allow the escort gunboats and frigates to fashion a defensive circle around them, but enemy lasers were chipping away at the perimeter, allowing droid fighters to dart through openings and prey on the larger vessels.
Sir, battle analysis is showing one capital ship reinforced by a Nebulon B frigate, multiple tri-droid fighters, and three, make that four, starfighters. Two friendly tugs, two escort gunboats, and more than a squadron of ARC 170s are already out of the fight.
Tarkin took in the scene. Same cobbled together Providence-class warship, same swarm of droid fighters and antique starfighters. Only this time he was commanding the counteroffensive, and instead of Sentinel Base,
The enemy's objectives were the hyperdrive components he had been worried about since leaving for Coruscant. Pivoting away from the viewports, he made his way down the observation gallery to watch a simulation of the attack resolve above a holotable. The spherical defense mounted by the Imperial escorts was being dismantled by steady fire from the warships. Pieces of gunboats and frigates drifted through a frenzied nimbus of ARC-170s and droid starfighters in pitched combat.
V-Wing fighters are away, the non-com who had followed him down the observation gallery updated. Tactical net is viable, and the wing commander is awaiting your orders.
They are to engage with the frigate and the carrier, and leave the droid fighters to the convoy escorts. Tarkin regarded the simulation for a moment longer, then paced forward to rejoin the officers at the viewports. By shunting ships to systems imperiled by the carrion spike, Naval Command and Control had left the convoy defenseless. Like Tarkin, taken in by the dissident's ruse. Had he not been called to Coruscant, he never would have allowed the convoy's defensive escorts to be redeployed elsewhere, and it irked him that he had not made a stronger case for his remaining at Sentinel. He could only hope that the Emperor had made a wise choice in allowing Rancits and the Shipjacker's ploy to unspool, and that all of them were now caught up in the net. He narrowed his eyes at the enemy carrier, wondering whether the crew that had pirated the carrion spike was aboard, or if the Shipjackers had gone into hiding after deserting the corvette.
The enemy carrier is repositioning, the bridge officer said. Looks like they're trying to put the convoy between us and them.
Tarkin nodded to himself as he watched the hodgepodge ship disappear behind the convoy and, recalling the tactics the dissidents had employed at the Findar fuel tank, thought, yes, this was the same crew.
Wing commander reports heavy resistance from the enemy fighters, someone said behind him. They're having trouble reaching the capital ships. Assessment scans indicate that two of the convoy transports have sustained significant damage.
Tarkin turned to the spec.
Still no communication with the convoy leader?
None, sir. We can't penetrate the jammers.
That was not welcome news. Tarkin couldn't be certain which of the transports was carrying basic supplies and which contained components critical for the mobile battle station.
Jova's voice whispered in his ear.
Only glory can follow a man to the grave.
Commander, he said, with an abrupt turn to the officer central to the rest, set us on a course into the midst of the battle. A tall man with a fringe of black hair, the commander, stepped away from the viewports to approach him.
With permission, Governor Tarkin, we have no way of warning the friendlies in our path.
Tarkin firmed his lips.
They'll get out of our way or they won't, Commander.
I won't argue with that, but even if we manage to penetrate the defensive sphere without incident, we've barely enough space to squeeze between the transports.
We'll worry about that when we have to. I will not chase that carrier in circles.
Tarkin's eyes narrowed.
Death or renown, ladies and gentlemen?
Sir.
As the commander left his side, Tarkin glanced at the bridge officer.
Our batteries are to refrain from firing until I give the command. Alert the wing commander that for the time being he and his pilots are our artillery. The droid fighters are slow to react to chaos. I want our starfighters to break formation and improvise, firing at will.
Clear, sir.
Tarkin resumed his stance. This was how the Empire would conquer and rule, he thought. Through might and fear. The Executrix lumbered through the congestion of starfighters and into the thick of battle, where the cargo ships and transports were being pounded by cannon and turbolaser fire from the Nebulon B frigate and the carrier. Explosive light pulsed blindingly beyond the viewports.
All forward batteries are to concentrate fire on the frigate, Tarkin ordered.
Local space lit up as dozens of energy beams loosed by the Star Destroyer converged on the much smaller vessel. In moments, the ship's shields were overwhelmed, and the beams began to take their toll, obliterating the Nebulon's rudder-like ventral appendage, then severing the spar that connected the main body of the ship to the engine module. Cracked open, the ship spilled its contents into space and imploded, sucking countless droid fighters into its blistering collapse.
Battle speed,
Tarkin said. The Executrix surged forward,
slipping like a needle between two of the larger transports, its pointed bow in direct line with the enemy carrier, which seemed to rear up in reaction to the Star Destroyer's relentless approach. The bridge officer spoke up. Wing Commander reports that his squadrons are being carved to pieces. Tarkin kept his eyes on the carrier. It wasn't turning tail as it had its sentinel. This was the moment the scenario would change. This was the moment the dissidents would demonstrate their unshakable commitment. Order the starfighters to withdraw into our wake and to protect the convoy at all costs, he said at last. Carrier is changing vector, the spec all but shouted into his left ear. Flank speed at the convoy leader. Tarkin's eyes tracked the ship's abrupt swing to port and sudden acceleration. 10 degrees port. Starboard ion batteries go to steady fire. Race to the light of the lasers. If Teller wasn't careful, astonishment was going to be the death of him. The sneak attack on the convoy had commenced without incident, with several Imperial support vessels destroyed and the cargo ships themselves jeopardized. Until a Star Destroyer, certainly Tarkin's Star Destroyer, had reverted to real space and turned the battle on its ear. V-Wings were decimating the droid fighters, and a headhunter and a Tikiar had been obliterated, leaving only Teller's ship and the Tikiar piloted by a Kurovar he had trained on Antar IV. The warship itself was now pushing into the heart of the fray, as if intent on going head-to-head with the Star Destroyer, but was in fact on a collision course with the bulkiest of the cargo vessels. Energy began to coruscate across the hull as it continued its desperate charge for the convoy transports. If it was Tarkin's aim to confound and confuse, he had done so brilliantly. The V-Wing fighters were creating such chaos, it was impossible to predict what Tarkin would do next. And where a more cautious commander might have steered a course around the chaos, Tarkin was taking the massive ship right into the middle of it, placing not only himself but his own pilots and everyone else in peril. Teller had made repeated attempts to raise Salek and the others on the battle net without success. Abruptly, the interference abated, and Salek's face resolved in flickering fashion on the cockpit display screen. Teller got right to the point. "Get clear and jump the ship to hyperspace while there's still time," he told the Gotl.
"Back to you, Teller," Salek said,
through a pall of smoke drifting over the warship's bridge.
"Get clear of that Star Destroyer."
Salek shook his head.
"We're already committed."
"You'd have a better chance of flying into a supernova."
Honora leaned into cam range from behind the captain's chair.
"Teller, haven't you ever seen a holodrama? You're the one who's supposed to live to fight that other day."
Teller grimaced for the cockpit cam.
"I'm not the one being dramatic. I'm the one who's talking sense."
"Listen to her," Salek said. "For my part, I'll always be grateful for the extra years you gave me after Antar."
Teller's nostrils flared.
"You dumb, flat-faced space jockey."
Salek ignored the insult.
"I'm transmitting jump coordinates to your fighter. Ease out of the fight while Tarkin is concentrating on us. The headhunter's hyperdrive will do the rest."
Honora nodded soberly.
"Looks like we're destined to be martyrs after all, Teller. Over and out,"
Salek said, before Teller could reply.
"Carrier's shields are failing," a tech updated.
"The carrier is modular," Tarkin said.
"If we can't blow it to pieces, we can certainly dismantle it. Order armaments to target the assembly points." Coherent light from the Executrix's turbo laser batteries stratified local space, skewering the carrier like a beast set upon by lance-wielding hunters. Debris streamed and corkscrewed from jagged breaches in the ship's belly, and illumination systems began to wink out from stern to bow. Two modules, blown from the main body, pirouetted away from the ship and exploded. The sublight engines flared and died.
"Droid fighters are powering down," the tech updated. "Holonet's signal to noise is better than 50%.
"Our lasers must have found the master control computer," the bridge officer said.
Its curved bow severed, and deflector shields sparking out, the carrier continued to come apart as Tarkin and the others watched, the droid fighters twirling about like storm-tossed leaves. Quartered by the Star Destroyer's cannons, what remained of the vessel listed to starboard and showed its belly to the vanquisher.
"Cease fire," Tarkin said.
The order had scarcely left his mouth when the speck spoke.
"Two marks reverting from hyperspace."
For a moment, Tarkin thought that he had stumbled into another trap, but then the tech said,
"Star Destroyer's compliant and enforcer from Imperial Marshalling Station Pi."
"Sir, we have one headhunter unaccounted for," a second tech said. "Sensors indicate that it may have jumped to hyperspace."
"We'll find it," Tarkin said. "In the meantime, ready a boarding party. I want the carrier crew taken alive."
Standing alone at the summit of the palace spire, the Emperor narrowed his eyes as he gazed out on Coruscant, spread below him like a stage set. The sky was clearing after a cleansing of the Federal District by weather control, and the skyscrapers and towering monads shone like new. The power of the dark side coursed through him like a transfusion of unsullied blood. Out there were people who wished him dead, others who envied his station, and still others who wished merely to be close enough to him to sate themselves on the crumbs he brushed aside. The thought of it was almost enough to transform his disgust to sadness for the plight of the ordinary. But the wretched practices of the Republic endured. Corruption, decadence, the lust for prestige. A penthouse in an elite building. A position that opened doors anywhere in the core, collections of priceless art, the finest foods, the most able servants. He never had need for any of it, even when a senator, even when Supreme Chancellor, and had subscribed to luxury only to satisfy juvenile fantasies, and, of course, because it was expected of him. Now he had only the dark side to answer to. And the dark side had an appetite for extravagance of a different sort. A plot had been foiled, a distraction laid to rest. Needless energy had been expended and resources wasted. Eventually the dark side would grant him infallible foresight, but until such time, future events would remain just out of clear sight, clouded by possibilities and the unremitting swirlings of the Force. He had made himself lord of all he surveyed, but he had much to learn. Actions meant to topple him from his lofty perch wouldn't end with the successful containment of this most recent fiasco. But he would deal with any who chose to challenge him with the same precision he had applied to exterminating the Jedi. And he would not allow himself to be sidetracked from his goal of unlocking the secrets many of the Sith masters before him had sought. The means to harness the powers of the dark side to reshape reality itself. In effect, to fashion a universe of his own creation. Not mere immortality of the sort Plagueis had lusted after, but influence of the ultimate sort.
As his empire swelled, bringing more and more of the outer systems into its fold, so too would his power unfurl, until every being in the galaxy was held captive in his dark embrace.
A search of the carrier's extant module yielded 13 dead crew members, humans, Korivar, and Gotols, and twice the number of survivors, representing the same mix of humans, humanoids, and non-humans. Tarkin stepped from one of the module's airlocks, as the latter group was being herded into a thoroughly ruined cabin space by the stormtrooper squads who had captured them. The floor was awash in fire suppressant foam, and the air reeked of fried circuitry and melted components. Tarkin waited for the prisoners to be shackled and formed up into two lines before conducting an inspection. He began with the inner line, stopping to regard each being before moving on. As he turned to move down the outer line, a smug smile softened his expression. "Anora Fair," he said, stopping in front of the only human female among the captives. "Though I see you've restyled your hair." Leaning back to glance farther down the line, His eyes settled on a willowy red-furred Zygerian female. And you would be Hask Taff. I trust you found the carrion spike to your liking. Neither uttered a word or altered her forward gaze. Not that he would have expected them to. A sidestep brought him eye to eye with a roomy-eyed, middle-aged man. Ah, the infamous Lantilles broker himself, Tarkin said. Nice of you to attend, Knots. The broker, too, stared straight ahead and offered no reply. Tarkin took a few more steps, stopping to look up into the face of a Mon Cal. Dr. Artos, perhaps? He stepped back from the line to address everyone. But where is Teller? When the silence had gone on long enough, he said. Left for dead in some other module? A starfighter casualty? He paused, then, with an eyebrow arched, added, Escaped. He gave them another long moment. Tell me, was it our late Vice Admiral Rancid who reached out to you, or did you approach him? Tarkin glanced at Knotts. Come now, Knotts. Both you and Teller answered to him during the war, did you not? Apparently your betrayal took him by surprise, spoiling the betrayal he planned for you. Again he waited. Nothing to say. No last-moment cheers of solidarity. No verbal abuse for the Empire, or for the Emperor himself. You'll fall from your perch soon enough, Tarkin, Honora Fair said, skewering him with an abrupt glare. And it won't be a soft landing. He grinned without showing his teeth. And here I was expecting an apology for the condition in which you left my ship. She managed to contort her shackled hands into an obscene gesture before one of the stormtroopers slammed her in the back of the head with his blaster rifle. So much venom from such a lovely mouth, Tarkin said. He took a backward step to scan the prisoners once more. Anyone else? Or shall I simply assume that she spoke for the lot of you? When no one replied, he shrugged. Well, never mind. I'm confident that once on Coruscant, we can find ways to loosen all your tongues. Chapter 22. Red in Tooth and Claw. The Emperor, Vader, and Tarkin, the Empire's newly formed Dark Triumvirate, met in private in the pinnacle chamber of the spire. The Emperor was in his customary chair, with Tarkin seated opposite him across the table. Vader remained standing, as he usually did when in the presence of his master. 3 weeks had passed since the attack on the convoy, most of which Tarkin had devoted to interrogating the captured conspirators and collaborators, with some assistance from Vader and ISB specialists. None had died during the process, though all had since been executed in secret. The ISB had advocated for making a public spectacle of their deaths, but the Emperor had ultimately rejected the idea, if only to deny the dissidents martyrdom. The details of Rancid's death, too, became a closely guarded secret, even among his peers in the intelligence community. But most got the message. No rank or position was a guarantee of privilege or exemption. Everyone was expendable. It's clear that he felt passed over, Tarkin was explaining to the Emperor. First, he was forced to disappoint his former operatives on Antar IV, due to a squabble between military intelligence and the ISB, and then he lost command of Sentinel Base, which he perceived as a demotion for having objected to the actions the Empire took on the Gotal Moon.
So, the plot began with him, the Emperor said.
Tarkin nodded. In a sense. He was informed, through back channels, of the conspirators' attempt to procure prescribed armaments, confiscated Separatist materiel, and communications jammers. When he learned, however, that the prospective buyers were former Republic intelligence operatives, he facilitated their access to Imperial depots and armories.
The warehouse workers and salvagers who supplied the conspirators have been dealt with,
Vader pointed out,
including several scientists at Desolation Station who violated the terms of their security oaths.
Tarkin waited for Vader to finish.
We've also determined that the warship was assembled at shipyards in the Bajic sector, jointly owned and operated by the Tanla Syndicate and lower-level members of the Crimora Syndicate. Along with those, our operatives discovered two clandestine facilities located elsewhere in the Outer Rim, both of them long abandoned. We did, however, succeed in tracing the whereabouts of some of those involved, and they have since been eliminated.
Good, the Emperor said. Let that be a lesson to all of them.
He narrowed his eyes at Tarkin.
Including the one who apparently got away.
The headhunter was found on Christophsis, Tarkin said, more defensively than he had planned.
You are certain the starfighter belonged to Teller?
Vader asked. His genetic fingerprints were all over it, Tarkin said.
An intelligence officer of Teller's skill would know better than to leave his ship to be found, much less his fingerprints.
Vader paused, then added,
He left us his calling card.
He's gone to ground, Tarkin said. Vader regarded him.
You don't believe that any more than I do.
Tarkin took a breath and blew it out. I don't suppose I do.
He paused.
Finally, there is the matter of funding for the warship, droids, and other materiel. Evidence points to the fact that Rancid played a role in diverting funds allocated to Naval Intelligence's black budget. But the investigation is ongoing. Others may have been involved.
The Emperor gestured in impatience. Was it Rancid who brought these malcontents together?
No. He wasn't responsible for assembling the cell, Tarkin said. The idea appears to have originated with Knotts or Teller. Or perhaps they were in league with each other from the start. But Rancid may have contributed the names of people known to be on ISB's watch lists for acts of sedition or sabotage. That may explain how the Mon Cal engineer came to be part of the cell. Though it's possible that Artos was enlisted while Teller was head of security at Desolation Station. The Mon Cal's involvement certainly explains their familiarity with the Carrion Spike, as well as with the convoy route.
But not the battle station,
the Emperor said.
No, my lord, Tarkin said. Many are aware that an Imperial construction project is in progress at Geonosis, but the mobile battle station is not in jeopardy. The Emperor steepled his fingers and fell silent for a long moment.
I will give the matter consideration.
Of course, my lord, Tarkin said. For Rancid, the plan entailed nothing more than allowing the conspirators to attack a few Imperial facilities. He promised them Corrida, but he never had any intention of allowing them to fire on the Imperial Academy. In fact, he attempted to betray them earlier by incapacitating the Carrion Spike at Noain, but the dissidents managed to escape.
What case did the dissidents make for attacking the Academy?
That an attack would send a message to potential enlistees, Tarkin said. But of course their principal target all along was the convoy. They were counting on the fact that Rancid would go to great lengths to assure that his subterfuge was beyond suspicion, as was his wont during the Clone Wars. Thus the starship allocations and redeployments. We suspect that the conspirators had a short list of secondary targets as well, and were monitoring Rancid's ship dispositions. When he inadvertently fulfilled their hope that the battle station convoy would be left relatively unprotected, their decision was made. The Emperor's furtive smile gave Tarkin pause. Had he actually seen through Rancid's and the dissidents' schemes from the beginning? Had the events of the past few weeks been less about unmasking a cell of traitors than testing Tarkin's ability to foil the plot and to work effectively with Vader? Along with planning to betray two of the men he worked most closely with during the Clone Wars, Tarkin went on, Rancid outwitted the Naval Intelligence's security cams and also managed to dupe both Deputy Director Isom and Vice Admiral Screed.
Perhaps I should have made him a moth after all, the Emperor said with obvious sarcasm. He might have had a brilliant career if ambition hadn't brought him down.
Tarkin adopted a tight smile. My lord,